This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is your host, Chris Hoff. We are now at episode 29, and thanks for listening. I have a really great episode for you today. I think you're going to really get a lot out of it. It was very informative for me. We're going to be talking about climate change with Tom Bowman. But before we get there, I wanted to make a couple of quick announcements. First one, I'm really excited to announce that I launched a YouTube channel. So The Radical Therapist now has a YouTube channel. And you can find it at our website. We have a direct link on the website at theradicaltherapist.com, but you can search it for it in YouTube under The Radical Therapist or my name, Chris Hoff. And I would really appreciate it if you sought it out and subscribed and even maybe watched a couple of the videos. We have a few videos up now. The most recent one was on heterosexism and becoming affirmative. And we have a live video where I was at the Women's March here in California, which I think you might find entertaining. So please seek those out. And also, as always, I have Radical Therapist stickers to send out. So if you're interested in getting some stickers, please just reach out to me at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. And I would be happy to send those to you. Just let me know where you are, and we'll do that. So, like I said, I'm really excited about this show. We're treading into the waters of science, and we haven't done that in a while. So I'm happy to be doing that. And I'm really happy that I think you'll really be impressed with our guest, Tom Bowman. I'm really excited that I was able to get him in studio to chat with us. And a little bit about Tom. Tom is the founder and CEO of Bowman Change, which is a consultancy dedicated to helping organizations reap the benefits of working with purpose, making social issues and environmental change central to their missions. And Tom is also a sought-after advisor and communicator, and he regularly provides counsel on climate engagement and science communications to federal agencies, including the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the National Science Foundation, National Aeronautics and Space Administration, and the White House Council on Environmental Quality. He also provides counsel to professional organizations and NGOs such as the American Geophysical Union, American Public Health Association, and the American Governors Association. Tom's academic training includes a BA from Johnston College and a master's from the University of Southern California in social ethics. And he's just a really knowledgeable guy. I think you're going to really get a lot out of this podcast. So let's not waste any more time and let's go chat with Tom. All right. Welcome to the show, Tom. Glad you're here.
Well, thanks, Chris. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I appreciate you taking the time. And I think these are interesting times we're living in, obviously.
No kidding.
Especially with the topic that you're well-versed in. And so before I get into some other questions, I guess just for our audience and even my sake, I don't quite particularly know, how did you become involved in the work of climate change?
Yeah, it was in a way a long and winding route. I have had one of the most unusual jobs a person can have for a long time. For 25 years, I owned a small design agency, and we specialized in doing exhibition work. So we designed exhibits for corporations that went to trade shows. But we got, and we worked with Southern California Edison to create energy education exhibits at a education center they have. So I was used to telling complicated stories to the general public for our clients. We had an opportunity to design a new science museum in Washington, D.C. for the National Academy of Sciences back in, it started in 2003. The museum opened in 2004. And I don't know if you know about the National Academies. They are an honor society of scientists. The National Academies consists of the National Academy of Sciences, the National Institutes of Health, and the National Academy of Engineering. So to become a member, you have to have done significant work in your field. And then those members are called upon to issue reports in response to questions from the White House or Congress. They're private, they're autonomous, but all of the National Research Council reports you hear about anything from fluoride in the water to whether we should go to Mars, anything, come out of the National Research Council. So they have a really intense, deliberative process of summarizing information and reviewing it. So we got the chance to design a museum for them in Washington. And in my field, the chance to design a museum in Washington is once in a lifetime, ever, opportunity, right? And the first project we did was on climate change, which meant that I spent a good 6 or 9 months in an intensive tutorial with some of the most respected climate scientists in the world on a committee. And we opened that exhibit in 2004. And at the time, the attitude among the scientists was, this is a really unprecedented and serious problem. Fortunately, we have some time to figure this out before things get really serious for us. And I kind of went back to my life with that thought in mind and proceeded to do my business. Then I got a call in 2006 from the Birch Aquarium, which is part of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography down in La Jolla, San Diego. They do an enormous amount of Earth system science research. So they, a lot of authors on the IPCC reports, and which is the international body that does climate assessments every 6 years, they all come from institutions like Scripps and major universities. So they wanted to do an exhibit to open in 2007 on the anniversary of a guy named Charles David Keeling measuring CO2 in the atmosphere continuously since 1957 on the top of a volcano in Hawaii, out in the, where the air is pure, you know. And the attitude among the scientists in those few years had flipped 180 degrees because melting in the Arctic had accelerated. The climate was changing faster than anybody thought. China's economy was growing so fast that we were pumping more carbon dioxide into the air than anybody ever thought we would. And so there was a new sense of urgency mixed with the very methodical processes of doing science. And there was a day when I was talking to the science curator at the aquarium about the material for that project, when I had, according to the dictionary definition of the word epiphany, I had an epiphany about climate change. An epiphany is, quote, a sudden intuitive insight into the reality of something, unquote. And she made a comment to me that hit me sort of right between the eyes. And it was that the folks at the academies had told me, pay attention to warming in the ocean, because the oceans, which cover 3/4 of the world, can absorb so much heat before the temperature rises that once it starts to rise, they'll act like a giant flywheel. The oceans are the stabilizer of our climate system. So when that starts to warm, it means we're committing the world to a warming climate for 500 to 1,000 years, right? And I mentioned that to her, and she just casually said, oh, we're part of a project that has robotic floats all over the world, 3,000 robotic floats, and we've already measured warming in every ocean basin in the world to a depth of 1,000 meters.
Wow.
That's 3,000 feet.
Wow.
My hackles literally went up on the back of my neck. And the next words out of her mouth were, our director would like to meet you for the first time. And the funny thing is that when you own a business, the most important thing is to always be cool. Nothing's ever a problem, right? Don't worry, we'll take care of it. And I walked into her office literally having a hard time breathing. And she said, she looked at me and she said, is there anything you'd like to ask me? And I just blurted out. I said, yeah, how do you cope with knowing what you know? And the thing is that at the time, there weren't other communication professionals who understood the climate science very well. And so I felt an obligation to figure out what can I do. And I gathered together a whole bunch of climate scientists, economists, psychologists, social psychologists, people who are experts in policy, people who are experts in education and communication campaigns. And we put together something called the Climate Solutions Project, which was going to be a big touring festival back in 2008. And we got a grant. We spent about 2 days in an intensive retreat figuring out what we wanted to accomplish. And then the economy collapsed and all of the available funding streams dried up. And so I just began a sort of a winding path. I started a consultancy to work on climate communication projects that didn't involve exhibits. I ultimately sold my design firm. I decarbonized my little company on our own. We won a statewide award, which caused me to be introduced to lots of small business owners who were doing incredible things, remarkable things to decarbonize, to promote the environmental health, to promote social justice among their workers. This is a huge untapped resource in our society nobody knows about because small business owners don't talk about what they do. They just go to work.
Right.
And I've gathered twice groups of people who study public opinion about climate change and social psychologists to study, to assess what do we know about public opinion about climate change. I've been involved in all kinds of different projects, which means I've interacted with experts in lots of different disciplines on this issue. It's an ongoing journey.
Yeah. Great. So I was going to ask you about the new administration, but I think I'm going to put that towards the back. And this podcast is probably going to be titled something around the like the psychology of climate denial or what have you. And I guess I'm really interested in your thoughts about why humans are so, I guess, unwilling or unable to deal with this issue.
Well, let's take a step back for a second and think about what climate change is.
Sure.
We don't experience climate. We experience weather, right? Outside, right now it's overcast, kind of cool. It's in the low 50s. The clouds are going to burn off where we are. It's going to get into the probably high 60s or 70s today, right? That's the weather. And we always experience what the weather is all the time. And weather forecasters are very good at predicting the weather out to about 10 days, right? They use complicated computer models. They pretty well know what's going to happen in about 10 days. Beyond that, there's enough variation in what happens that the predictions become a lot less reliable. They can get out to about 30 days, and that's really the limit at all. Climate is the pattern, the persistent patterns of weather that we have. So here we are in Southern California on the coast, right? We have a Mediterranean climate. So it's mild but warm in the summers. It's mild but cool in the winters. We get most of our rain in the winter months and early spring. We get almost none in the summers. They're long and hot and dry. That's our climate. That's our relative pattern, right? So the first thing is that nobody experiences climate. We only experience weather.
Right.
And so that means that climate is an abstraction, right? You have to think about it.
Right.
Whereas weather is an immediate visceral response, right? It doesn't take any effort. So that's the first thing. And people conflate the two all the time. The second thing is that humans have only been around for about 100,000 years, 200,000 years. And in all of that time, we've been coming out of the last ice age. The world has been warming and it's kind of stable. And you look back in the historical record, there have been lots and lots of ice ages and warm periods. But we as a species have no experience of that. Even more importantly, we started planting crops about 10 or 12,000 years ago and forming cities, settlements. We stopped being nomads about that time. And this is when we think of high culture starting to develop. The climate has been, if you look at the historical record, the climate of the Earth has been unusually stable for the last 10,000 years. You see this up and down pattern of warming and cooling, and then for 10,000 years, it's a straight level line. Which means that all of civilized history, all of our folklore, all of the passing of experience from generation to generation is based on an incredibly stable patterns of weather. And what climate change says is we've just perturbed that in a really dramatic way. We've added so much heat-trapping gas to the atmosphere that it's outside the bounds probably of a million years, right? And so on the one hand, we don't have any experience of this ever. And then we're being told that what we have done inadvertently just by living our lives, driving our cars, heating our homes, turning on the lights, cooking our food, all the things that we take for granted as the conveniences of modern life, have fundamentally changed the climate system in ways no humans have ever experienced, ever. by a dramatic margin, and that we are only now beginning to experience the consequences. The real consequences come in 20, 40, 80, 100 years, right? That's a hard thing to wrap your head around,
right?
Because it's conceptually doesn't sort of fit our day-to-day experience. But the other thing is that it is such a fundamental shakeup of, it says to us that nature is not really trustworthy. Nature's not really on our side in a way that we've always assumed that it is. Mm. And I think that one of the unspoken challenges in all of this is that there's something fundamentally disturbing about that, you know? And we can explore that. We can also explore, on top of all of this, are two other really important factors, I think. One is that almost all of the effort to communicate about climate change has come from the science community. Mm-hmm. And their mission is to tell us what their research says about this really important problem. They tell us what's changing, why it's changing, what the evidence is that it's changing, and what's likely to happen in the future, right? But they absolutely don't address the question of, can we do anything about it effectively? Mm-hmm. The answer is overwhelmingly yes. But nobody's telling that story. And so if you look at the surveys, large majority of Americans say, yes, this is real. Yes, it's a problem. Yes, it's going to be harmful. And it's human caused. And then you ask, can we solve this and will we solve it? And something like 6% of Americans answer yes to that question. And why rearrange the chairs on the Titanic, right? Okay. People 6%, feel that way. 6%. Yeah. Yeah, the question is can and will, and that's I think that's an important and unfortunate combination. The other thing is that in the face of this, the public has been subjected to a really well-organized, persistent campaign to dissuade them from believing that scientists even agree about climate change. Mm-hmm. And this goes back to 2002 in the Bush administration, or maybe a little later. And a Republican strategist named Frank Luntz wrote a memo to them, which leaked. And the memo said, the public attitudes about climate change are starting to gel, and once they do, the public will demand action. Your opportunity is to keep the public from believing that the science community has come to agreement about this. And so they have done that, and they've been well-financed by the fossil fuel industry in doing this behind the scenes. They have the conservative talk radio network to repeat their talking points persistently day in and day out. They've got Fox News to do it. And so the result is it's easy to keep people off kilter. Lots of people believe this is a problem, but they're not really 100% confident in that belief. And that makes it hard to force political action.
Yeah. And I watched you give a talk, and you said something that I thought was fascinating and true in a lot of ways, that most people, the only scientist they know is their TV.
Isn't that remarkable?
Weatherman, yeah, or weather person. I guess I'm wondering, how do we reclaim how do you get control of the communication again, or reclaim the stories, or create a new story?
Yeah.
Or,
you know. Yeah. Well, on the one hand, there is an effort to work with TV weather meteorologists to get them to sharpen what they say. Yeah. There used to be a lot of damaging back and forth banter between the anchor person and the, you know, oh, it's cold outside, so much for global warming, and they'd laugh. Well, that sticks.
Yeah.
The other thing is that we need more voices. We need different voices. You know, scientists are a trusted source on this issue, but they're not the people who can describe how we solve this problem. That comes from the business community. Business leaders, it comes from the public health community, it comes from people who are experts in policy, but maybe they're not advocates, you know, not aggressive advocates, so they don't sort of stir up the two sides of the coin every time they talk. And we're beginning to see a little bit of it. But when economists and business leaders say, look, we've already voted with our pocketbooks, fossil fuels are not the future for us, we're moving beyond them, they're obsolete. That sends a very, very strong signal, and it can build confidence because in fact, that's what's happening. Hmm. Yeah.
You mentioned public health, and I guess as a kind of a systemic therapist and yeah. interested in a larger cultural context.
Yeah.
What is public health's role in this? I mean, how would you communicate to people why this is important to their lives, to their well-being, to their wellness, to their those kinds of things?
Do you like having asthma? Right? Yeah. Do you like having heart disease? Do you like dealing with extreme heat? Do you like dealing with increase in smog, photochemical smog? These are. Do you like dealing with injuries in disasters, in floods, in storms? Because you know all of the really pernicious thing about climate change is that we experience it as weather in more extreme ways, right? So more floods, more storms, more droughts, hotter heat waves, more and longer heat waves, more photochemical smog because it forms on hot sunny days. In other words, the things that we already dislike and struggle with from a health point of view are all going to be exacerbated. And that means that people who are already the most vulnerable will be even the elderly, young children, people who work outdoors, people with compromised health, people who have a hard time psychologically coping with these kinds of hard conditions. All those people are going to suffer most. And they already are. We're already seeing that happening. So, and we're going to see infectious diseases spread more easily into ranges where they never have gone before. So, you know, the public health community calls this the most important public health concern in history.
They do.
They do. Yeah. And the issue, kind of like with weather broadcasters, is to get that message out into the field among working professionals to start. You know, climate change requires all of us to think about our comfort zones. This isn't anybody's job, right? This doesn't fall under anybody's job description, right?
Right. Yeah.
If you're a health professional, your job is to deal with whatever niche in public health, in health you work in, and try to move that forward. If you're a scientist, you're not supposed to talk about advocacy and policy. You're supposed to talk about science evidence. And this is an issue that sort of pushes all of us to say, wait a minute, I need to sound the alarm. I need to encourage people to take this seriously and take action. And so there is an effort within the public health community now to advance this kind of messaging. And some of it is coming from the American Lung Association. You know, here in Southern California, we still have bad smog. It's a lot better than it used to be, but it's still bad. And if we solve our air pollution problem, we also reduce global warming. So, you know, then there's the question of, do we need to attack it as climate change, or do we attack it for the things that we already care a lot about, people already care a lot about: clean water, clean air, clean soil, clean food, things like that.
Yeah. What's your experience of the international community? Somebody just told me a story about going to Beijing and having, not wearing one of those masks, but actually getting like a gas mask kind of thing to walk around in. And but I also heard you sharing when we were chatting last night, as a matter of fact, about like some things that like Norway is doing.
Right.
So there's, what's your experience with the international community?
The developed world is way ahead of us on this issue. Mm-hmm. Americans are the laggards. We are historically the biggest polluter. We are now second to China in terms of carbon pollution. China just canceled 103 new coal-fired power plants that were on the books, of which were already under construction for the last 10 years or so. And they canceled them and said, we'll have a surplus of coal power. They're building renewables faster than anybody in the world. Their economy is so huge. That's why they outpace everybody. In, I think it's Norway, after 2030, or 2020, you'll not be able to heat a new building with fossil fuels. It'll be illegal. In Germany, you won't be able to sell a fossil fuel powered car. So no gas, no diesel, will have to be electric or hydrogen fuel cell.
And when does that start?
I think it's either 2020 or 2030. Wow. I forget the dates. Yeah. Germany has what's called a feed-in tariff. If you put solar on your roof, the power company buys power from you. And it has caused, you know, when you make those kind of policies, the marketplace moves in a heartbeat. Even here in America, Everybody said we can't get away from coal-fired power plants until 2050, 2060, because, you know, power plant builders need to amortize the cost of building it, so they need to burn coal all that time. Well, it turns out a coal plant can be modified to burn gas, which has a lower carbon footprint. And when the mercury rules about coal pollution came out a few years ago, and then fracking started and the price of gas plummeted, it became cheaper to burn gas than to burn coal. And they all switched within like 2 years. This wasn't supposed to happen for 30 years until 30 years from now. And the bottom fell out of the U.S. coal market. This is really how change happens. The marketplace sees an advantage and everybody jumps on board. And then all of a sudden, the technologies that are causing problems become obsolete. And, you know, politicians are kind of trying to catch. Now, politicians can, like they do in California, can advance this by setting standards that encourage innovation and adoption. But they can't stop the trend, right? Once it becomes cheaper to be cleaner, everybody's going to be cleaner.
Right. Okay. So how are you feeling about alternative energy sources like solar and wind? And do you feel like, I mean, they've been around for a while, but there's a slow adaption to it, maybe.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So
it's a lot like, do you remember, I remember being in high school and our math teacher bought a $1,000 calculator. It was one of the first calculators, and he would bring it to class and he would let people use this thing. And it was $1,000 in the 1970s, right? Now you buy them for $2, a buck,
right.
Something like that. They're included in everything. All technology advances that way. And so this year alone, last year alone, the price of solar panels fell by 25%. And the adoption rate, almost all of the new investment in large scale power generation is in wind and solar. There's almost none in coal or gas, in fact. So there's some, not none, but not that much. The renewables are still a very small percentage of our power mix, but it's growing very, very rapidly. And so we're kind of at the crest of the wave where everything's going to accelerate. And the question is how quickly will it accelerate and how much damage will we do waiting for that to happen? And will government help us speed that along, or will government act like a roadblock?
Well, that's probably a good time to ask your about your thoughts for the new administration. There's already been some movement at the EPA and control of communication. And so how are you thinking about this new administration?
Well, it couldn't be a worse situation. I mean, and in a way, you know, I don't know how people feel, your listeners feel about politics, but I'm going to just lay out a few facts. The Tea Party was founded by a combination of the Koch brothers and a very heartfelt public populist anger against the government that didn't listen to them. And this is well documented in lots of reports. The Koch brothers, who are a huge private fossil fuel concern, and they're libertarians politically, that's their point of view, they sort of created the intellectual infrastructure, but then let the public run with it, right? And the Republican Party has pretty much made common cause with that, with the fossil fuel industry's agenda. And, you know, a lot of them come from coal-producing states and oil-producing states. It kind of makes sense that they would have that agenda. And so their effort is to try and preserve what worked in their districts in the past. And when a technology becomes obsolete, it's costly to a lot of people and it's disruptive. And it's uncomfortable. And so the bigger picture is that inevitably we're moving to a clean energy economy. And one way to look at what the Trump administration is doing with their selection of EPA pick and Rex Tillerson to be Secretary of State and all that is a backlash and an attempt to prevent history from moving forward. I don't think ultimately they'll be successful, because I don't think they can stop the momentum in the marketplace, but I think they can cause a lot of damage along the way. And there's going to be a lot of galvanized resistance to it. And we're in for wild times, no matter what. We're in for wild times.
Right. Okay. currently there's a lot of people interested in activism. You're seeing that happening now.
Oh, yeah.
And I guess I'm wondering, what do you think people can do to, when it comes to climate change, communicate their concerns more effectively?
This is going to sound strange, but when back in 2008, when we were working on the Climate Solutions Project, I had all these experts in the room, and I just thought, I should ask everybody, what is your primary goal? What do you want this project to accomplish? And when it came to me, I surprised myself. I said, I want people to talk about climate change with their family and friends and coworkers. And I think today that's probably still the most important thing we can do. Climate change is off limits in conversation, in business, in polite company, in social situations, and just breaking the ice, just being able to say, hey, I'm really worried about this. Are you worried about this? Are you hopeful about this? It seems like things are different now. Butterflies are coming around different time. My flowers bloom at a different time. Whatever it is, these storms seem stronger. Is that climate change? Just start talking about it. And then if you want to be an activist, there is the Indivisible Guide, which was written, so you can get it online, just Google Indivisible Guide. And it was written by a bunch of congressional staffers from the last administration as an instructions to how to get your voice heard. And they basically say, work locally, work with your own elected reps. It doesn't help to contact a senator from another state. They don't care. They only care about their own constituents, and
right. Yep.
And express your and basically put them on notice in large numbers that this matters and that you're going to vote the issue.
Right. Okay. So give us some good news, Tom.
You know, this is so funny because every client says, okay, now we've told the horrible story. Now we have to talk solutions and, you know, don't make it depressing. And 6, 8, 10 years ago, it was hard not to do that. But the good news is that I think the best news is that business and the rest of the world are taking this very seriously. The Paris Agreement is a remarkable thing because every nation of the world signed on to it. That's what's remarkable. Whether it's strong enough to solve climate change on its own isn't the point. The point is that every nation said we will make commitments to do our part. The second piece of good news, believe it or not, is in China. The fact that they were building coal-fired power plants at a pace of one a week for a long time, and now they're turning their back. They're tired of the pollution. They know what climate change will do to their food supply and their water supply, you know, and all of that. And they are they're the leader in adopting renewable energy. And the great news is that when you're part of a big economy, you basically change the world. And California is good news. California is the world's sixth largest economy all by itself. And California is a test case for whether you can reduce global, you know, carbon emissions economy-wide. And they set a very aggressive goal back in 2006 for 2020, and we're almost there already. They've set more aggressive goals for 2030 now, and it's not all the way there, but the die is cast. California voted. California voters support it over and over again at the ballot box, and California's economy is flourishing because of it. So you see electric cars everywhere. You see Tesla here. You see BMWs that can go 200 miles on a charge now. You see the Chevy Bolt coming out. Everybody's in the transportation world is developing electric cars because they know that it's the future.
Right.
And so the other good piece of news is that you can decarbonize your home and your business inexpensively and benefit from it. So my own little company, 2,000 square foot building, 10 people, reduced our carbon emissions by 2/3 in 15 months. I had to replace an air conditioner. It cost me $7,000 to do the air conditioner and duct work. I was saving $9,000 a year. Not just on energy, but on all. I replaced my car with SUV with a Prius, a company car. We didn't do solar. We couldn't afford it. So we just did simple things. We plugged everything into power strips and turned all the power strips off at night so that you know, TVs and computers and VCRs are all using power when they're turned off. So you put them in a power strip and you turn that off, or you buy a smart power strip, turns itself off, and you're not using any electricity, which means you're not paying for any electricity. Yeah. So this means all of us can cut our own emissions substantially without really trying very hard. And then if you want to, you can now have a solar system put on your roof and pay less than you're paying for electricity today if you use enough power. Mm. So there's all kinds of ways to take action and feel good about it. And we're not moving fast enough, but we're starting to move in the right direction.
Yeah, so and that's great, and I appreciate those suggestions. And where would you direct people if they want to know more about how they can reduce their carbon footprint?
This is not so easy to find. electric utility companies have a lot of information about how to be energy efficient. They don't make it easy to get, though, because their websites are not all that user-friendly. You can look at a place called coolcalifornia.org, C-O-O-L, coolcalifornia.org, and there is a calculator for businesses, primarily small business, but I think they might have a residential calculator, too, that will help you kind of roughly figure things out without having to figure out too much. But here's the deal. If you're, the goal is to use as little energy as you possibly can. So next time you buy a car, buy the most energy efficient car that will meet your needs. And think hard about whether you need a big heavy vehicle to actually meet your needs or not. I'm a California male. It was hard to sell a four-wheel drive and buy a Prius, but you know what? The Prius does everything I need it to do, and it's great, and I hardly ever buy gas, right?
Yeah.
And that's a huge advantage. Yeah. So think about that. Always buy Energy Star appliances and light bulbs and televisions, because Energy Star is a rating that is applied to the most energy efficient products in any category. And as soon as half the products in the category qualify, they raise the standard. Mm. So an Energy Star refrigerator today is a lot more efficient than one was 5 years ago. So always buy Energy Star and you're using less. Take advantage of natural ventilation and daylight as much as you can. Turn things off when you're not in the room. I mean, some of this stuff is just, you know, it feels naggy or it feels too simple. Mm. But these are the things that help. Those are the simple things, right?
Right. And a lot of simple things measure up to big things.
When everybody does them, you bet.
Right. And so I wanted to ask you about this, get your thoughts. I was at a conference, like it's kind of an interesting conference, at a Hammer Museum a while back. And I forget the gentleman's name, but he was from Caltech and he was talking about climate change. And mm-hmm. And that he seemed to think there was a lot of quick fixes. And one of the things I remember him saying is to kind of create a volcanic event in some ways, like letting like the chemtrail stuff, I guess, go mm-hmm. into the atmosphere to block
sunlight,
right? Something similar to what if we had a major volcano eruption, you know, would do, and it would reduce temperature 2-3 degrees or something like that.
Yeah.
What do you think about some of these? I know you're probably more well-versed in some of these quick fixes, but...
Yeah. These quick fixes are known in the trade as geoengineering.
Okay, yeah.
So we have one planet that we all depend on. Yeah. And what geoengineering is sort of a last-ditch experiment with the one planet we have, right? And so there's a lot of fear of any kind of effort to intervene on a global scale. The thing about volcanoes is that, the sulfides come out of volcanoes in huge quantities, and they get in the upper atmosphere and they reflect sunlight.
Right,
so
right,
shades the Earth, in effect. There was one in the... it was the 1800s or earlier. Mount Pinatubo or one of those blew in a big, big way, and it caused Europe to have a cold summer and lose all their crops for a year. Mm. So there are consequences of those kinds of experiments that are hard to predict. And the other thing is that that shade only lasts for a year or two or three. carbon dioxide stays in the atmosphere for decades, and it's like putting a thick blanket around the Earth and keeping it there for a long, long time. So these quick fixes are temporary, but they don't really get to the problem. Smarter move is to plant a lot of trees, because trees suck up carbon while they're growing. That's where the carbon that makes the that makes their trunks and leaves comes from. They suck it out of the air. So they are removing carbon dioxide until they become mature, and then they stop doing that because they've stopped growing. Mm. So reforesting is a good move, as long as in California, as long as it's drought tolerant. In other places, that's not the issue. But the most important thing we can do is just put less into the air. We're in a situation now where the climate's going to change some, and it's going to cause some problems, but it's not, we can be resilient. Okay. In the face of those, the real issue is getting rid of carbon emissions quickly enough that we don't cross really serious tipping points.
Okay, great.
In the future.
All right, Tom. Before I let you go, how can our listeners find you if they want to reach out to you and get some more information?
I'm easy, tombowman.com. Okay. Goes to my website. I did a podcast there for a while interviewing lots of experts on climate. But that's the easiest place to find me, and I'm more than happy to talk to anybody.
Great. And I will link it in the show notes so you can access it. And Tom, thank you for coming and sharing.
My pleasure.
It's been an education for me, and I really I love hearing you talk about it. I learn every time I sit down and talk with you. So,
well, thanks for the good work you're doing with the podcast.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. Appreciate it.
All right.
Bye. Well, that's our show. And as always, thanks for listening. I really appreciate it. And like I said earlier, I'd love to hear from listeners. If you want to reach out to me, do so via the email at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. And if you have suggestions, critiques, guest suggestions, that kind of thing, I'm happy to hear from you. And I would also love to send you stickers of the show if you're so interested. Just let me know. And also, we're all over social media. You can find us at Instagram at The Radical Therapist, on Twitter at The Rad Therapist. And we have a website, theradicaltherapist.com. Lots of ways to engage with the show. So please reach out. And as always, this has been the Radical Therapist Podcast. My name is Chris Hoff, and I really appreciate you listening.